You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
6 minutes after 11, it is a Thursday, which means, of course, it is time for the Literature Corner.
The Literature Corner.
We haven't done an actual author interview in a while. We've been having so much fun on the show talking about books, but not the folks who actually write them. And I'm very pleased to say that I'm joined by someone who has a lovely brand new book out. And the title of this book is Consistent or Confused? The Politics of Mbeki's Foreign Policy 1995 to 2007. And that's Oscar van Heerden. Also, one of the more interesting inscriptions I've had written by an author in a book for me before. To you, CBS, a possible friend going forward. Enjoy the read, man, says Oscar, signed by him when he dropped it off a couple of weeks ago. Oscar, that sounds like a threat, eh? A possible friend. I don't know what the conditions of friendship are, but we leave that ethical discussion for another day. It is an easy read, which is a good thing, and it is him puzzling through an area of, I think, South African political discourse in general we don't pay enough attention to, which is South Africa's place in the world, from the UN to Brussels, and of course to all sorts of diplomatic big issues, whether it be Omar al-Bashir or going back to the Mbeki days. You know how much discussion was reached up by our foreign policy in relation to Zimbabwe. And it's a combination of international relations theory, trying to make sense of where South Africa fits in with all this kind of terminology, middle power, this, that, and the other, and using that as a basis to try and shed some light on the practical issues when it comes to real politics regionally as well as globally. First and foremost, Oscar, congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much.
How does it feel to have this out?
A relief. It's a 2-3 year project. You know, you finish your PhD and you're just sort of driven by trying to get that book out so that the general readership out there can also appreciate some of the discipline that you engage in. So I'm very relieved.
And how did you find the project transitioning from your PhD? Are you finished? Not all of us finish our PhDs, but it's always, of course, an additional challenge for those of you that have finished your PhDs to then make the stylistic change, because writing for academic assessors at Cambridge is a very different thing to writing for your average Joe. They need a different kind of style of writing, more your daily maverick pieces than what the actual academic treatise would have read like.
No, absolutely. I mean, and it is difficult. I'm not going to lie. You know, it's quite a mission to try and transform it, if you like, debunk some of the more heavier academic stuff. And I think I tried to do that in the first two chapters to sort of just make sure that the reader is familiar with some of the concepts, because I do think that having not done that, it would have been a bit of a challenge to wade through the book. But I hope that people find it refreshing. And as you say, some new concepts in international relations, soft power, middle power, where do we fit in? And of course, some of the international relations theory, just to sort of sharpen the analysis in terms of the book.
Before we get into that analysis, I want your reflections on where IR fits into our discourse. We know we obsess about personalities, occasionally about policy, less often about ideology, and then maybe it ends there. And as South Africans, I don't want to generalize, but I do think so many of us think that nothing happens north of Limpopo.
Yes.
So being involved in a discipline that tries to place South Africa in the world, like your postdoc supervisor has done. I mean, he was my hero growing up, making me want to do political analysis, and Chris Lunsberg. There isn't a ready appetite to talk about South Africa's place in the world, I think.
There isn't. And I think the link, Eusebius, is really about the fact that people need to have an understanding that foreign policy is directly linked to domestic politics. What plays out on the domestic political scene very much has an influence and an impact on how the world views us. Earlier you spoke on issues of Marikana, for example. Whether people are involved in trade negotiations in Brussels or whether they are trying to vote in a particular way at the United Nations, an incident like that immediately gets the kind of international coverage negative that impacts on South Africa's reputation, but also South Africa's standing within the international system. Mm. So the link really is about what we do at home has an impact abroad, but also what we do abroad does have influences. For example, in the book, I do try and demonstrate that though we negotiate a trade agreement with the European Union, it has fundamental impact on us as consumers back home as to what we're going to be paying for certain products. We can't call certain products port and et cetera, et cetera. These all have impacts. So that link is really where I think people do sometimes. We have 2 million plus, depending on who you speak to, Zimbabweans here legally and illegally. And that is because some would say how we manage that crisis north of Limpopo and so forth. So the link really is about domestic and foreign politics having such a, they are twins.
So we ought to pay more attention and not be so parochial.
I would definitely say that.
Before we get to Brussels, let's talk a little bit about Washington and New York. I mean, what's interesting is you try and take stock, for example, of South Africa's voting record when it comes to the United Nations and the Security Council. And that was quite interesting. I mean, I was sort of like, I thought I could predict what you might say just based on some of your public commentary. And I think you successfully complicate the different commentators, analysts, and academics' perspective of South Africa. And that gives it texture and gives it detail. It makes it a little bit hard, I think, at times to try and ascribe to you a very blunt and very clear position. Because some people will say, to your point about the domestic link with the link to international relations, that some of our voting patterns on some of the issues that you mentioned, like Myanmar, is inconsistent with a deep commitment to a human rights jurisprudence at home. And you try and make sense of the reality that the idea of a human rights-based foreign policy at any rate, anywhere in the world, is really just an undergraduate seminar pipe dream, that there are more complex dynamics at stake here. Talk us through that part of your case study, trying to make sense of consistency or confusion.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, CBS, the thing is, given our history in South Africa, it came as no surprise that the likes of Mandela and the leadership, the political leadership at the time, coming into the 90s, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and now being post-apartheid, put emphasis on putting the cornerstone of foreign policy on human rights.
Sure.
Nothing wrong with that. Always a good ideal to strive for and to uphold. Mm. And I do think that people need to have an appreciation that it is a complex issue in various parts of the world. With regards to the United Nations, you know, what the South Africans were trying to do, I think, and I argue in the book, as they entered that international system of governance again, they immediately wanted to do two things. One, position themselves back into that fray and their presence needs to be felt. With this human rights backdrop, as well as voluntary having given up weapons of mass destruction. So there's a lot of kudos there, a lot of credits. So that's the one thing. The second thing is that they needed to say, we think that there has been some measure of skewedness within the global governance system, and that the UN Security Council simply took on too much which fell outside of their jurisdiction. And so one of the first things the South Africans did was to argue that we needed to have a much stronger human rights commission. And that a lot of issues that does not necessarily pose an international security threat, but yet it is still unacceptable behavior on some parts, belongs in that forum. And so they tried to actively take it off the table of the UN Security Council, and that was perceived as being inconsistent on the part of the South Africans. They were saying, for example, on the issue of rape as a weapon of war, where we have these foreign armed soldiers going into territories, raping, plundering, and so forth, and not being actually prosecuted and accounted, brought to book. Now, the US was pushing this resolution, but wanted their own forces to be excluded. And South Africa said no. It's either for everyone or it's for no one. Because why should one or two be exempted? And so that was a difficulty. Later on, it got adopted. The Americans did adjust their position. But those were some of the issues. Again, lastly, on the Iranian weapons of mass destruction, nuclear crisis, there's some... in some quarters, they were saying the Iranians have ill intent. They wanted to develop a weapon of mass destruction and wipe Israel off the face of the earth, but could not provide any concrete evidence for such an assertion. And in terms of the regulations, in terms of the Atomic Energy Agency, any country can indeed practice peaceful technology within the nuclear environment. Mm. And so South Africa was merely saying, we can't deny the Iranians that option purely based on some assumption that they have some malintent.
Mm.
We need to rather send in inspectors, send in the appropriate institutions and investigate if indeed they do have such malintent. And so, as you say, it's not a binary relationship and things are not black and white when it comes to politics. And South Africa was just merely trying to push that line and say, look, let's just be clear who does what and where does it belong.
Mm.
And so that was misread by some of the international relations scholars, I think.
Mm. 17 minutes after 11, if you've got a question for my IR expert in general about the Mbeki years and foreign policy, or you want to talk about the book, if you've had a chance yet to pick it up, to buy it and to read it, Consistent or Confused, The Politics of Mbeki's Foreign Policy, 95 to 2007, by Dr. Oscar van Heerden. Give us a call on 011-883-0702 or in Cape Town on 021-446-0567.
The Literature Corner.
You know, that said, Oscar, the one thing, though, that struck me, and we saw this with, for example, how South Africa dealt with Libya, then you vote for one resolution, then you renege basically later on what you had voted for and even had co-sponsored, is that I'm not so sure, and I mean, I'm no expert here. I did a small little bit of work on Libya when I had my first fellowship, and I almost chuckled when I realized that some of the issues that us as commentators, particularly non-IR experts, would just like politics in general, were trying to debate, you know, which is, what is the strategic intent behind this vote? Why are we not supporting some universal resolution that condemns all discrimination, both racism and homophobia in one breath in Geneva, but someone says, no, 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 you're going to sully the memory of black people if you have racism and homophobia in one resolution. And I thought there must be some sort of grand strategic explanation. There must be some sort of ideology in terms of what our foreign policy is based on. And what I found, and that was just a small little bit of a couple of months of research, is that sometimes South Africa is hamstrung just by the technical expertise of some of the officials that are posted, whether it be to Brussels, Geneva, or to New York, and then those of us around the braai are having these grand ideological debates about our foreign policy. How much of a gap did you find there exists between the very coherent, complex mind of Thabo Mbeki and his vision for our place in the world and the reality of an underinvestment in the technical expertise of the officials?
You're absolutely right. You know, at the end of the day, we don't want to necessarily talk about individuals, but that kind of expertise levels are required in various ways. I'll give you another example also with regards to Libya. You know, we come post the Polokwane conference.
Mm.
There is this push of anti-Mbeki sentiment. And anyone and everyone that is supposedly associated with Mbeki and the Mbeki administration, there is some level of retribution. And so the entire team, Ambassador Kumalo and his entire team, has just abruptly withdrawn from New York because they are pushing a particular line. I'm not sure which line. And then you send a new team. No institutional memory, no experience in terms of how some of the forces within the UN maneuvers, and that innocence that is there supposedly with pushing a particular resolution into the UN Security Council is like a no-fly zone, doesn't literally in English refer to no-fly zone. anyone with half a brain would have known they are trying to smuggle, because we've seen it before, where no-fly zones resulted into full-blown conflicts in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and so forth. But because that institutional memory is not there, the expertise are not there, they simply vote for Resolution 1973, which then results in a conflict that end up with Muammar Gaddafi being killed and so on and so forth. So that's that, just to give you that example of where you need to be very careful. Having said that, I also want to say that I, in my personal opinion, do think that Derko has been slipping in terms of training of diplomats, career diplomats, and so forth. Far too often we find that Derka has become a dumping ground for those types that we don't want to deal with in the political scene domestically, and those that fall out of favor. So let's just make them commissioners and ambassadors and so forth.
What is the reason for that?
I think there
are many parts of the political edifice that can be political Siberia for those that are undesirable. Ambassadorial posts matter so much. The average informed U.S. citizen can tell you who is the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. The average informed South African can't tell you our ambassador. So why is it that international relations posts become political Siberia? Is it because there are no massive, unlike in the States, political implications if you get IR wrong, as it were?
I do think that it's about the leader. As you say, you know, with the Mbeki administration, he was much more of an international president, if you like. Foreign policy was his game. Africa was his priority. And so there was that focus and so forth. Similarly with Mandela, you know, we had to re-enter the constellation of international nations. We had to set up our embassies in countries that we weren't allowed in and so forth. So that focus was there. Mm. With Zuma, that wasn't the case. Mm. Clearly, there has been a shift away to concentrating more on domestic issues. And so I do think with the shift in policy, there comes a less emphasis on the international relations front. It's very sad. I do think that as South Africa and as a middle power, both in Africa but also globally, in the Group of 77, within the BRICS alliance, we do have quite a role to play. And I do think that it's unfortunate that we're diminishing that.
Absolutely. I interrupted you a little bit when you gave the example early on in our discussion about your book about Brussels. Now, Brussels is fascinating because when we talk about the UN, we often talk about peace and security, our voting patterns, whether the UN needs reform, all those old debates that we rehash. And although IR in general is under the radar in public discourse, I find that the kind of stuff that you're writing about in the book around trade and development, our early trade negotiations with the EU, the implications for some of the regional blocs that we also belong to here, is critically important. Just reflect for me on that a little bit. I mean, we see now with Theresa May, for example, it is gigantically complex to put together the optimal team to negotiate a deal that will, in realist terms, have the most possible returns for you as a country. Were we prepared for that? Because you give a view that suggests we didn't come out too badly, but this was complex territory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Complex. And quite frankly, I try and take the position two approaches, Eusebius. The one is that just that level of expertise that was required, you are dealing with a major economic bloc such as the European Union, who serves more than 20 countries and their national interests. And here you are, a little South Africa, wanting to optimize your return. If you ask me, it probably would have been better if we went in as a regional bloc, where we had 6 or 7 countries. But South Africa decided it was in their interest post-1994 to try and negotiate a substantial trade deal. And what was interesting with the negotiations is they used that newfound, that spirit of the Rainbow Nation, the miracle that has taken place. And they used that very optimally. So when they needed to call in Mandela on a critical issue, he would suddenly fly to Brussels and meet with some heads of states and say, you know, can't you compromise on this and that? Other African countries don't have that, Madiba. Mm. We used Parliament as and when we needed to actually bring them in. And, you know, with negotiations, what is interesting, because as I was doing the research, you also find that small things like the little tricks that the European Union commissioners play. They'd say, okay, you know, on this one we disagree, we'll have to consult, and it's going to take 4 days, perhaps 5, which then means your delegation from Malawi, from Kenya, from Uganda, have to stay in Brussels for another week. With that expenses, 5-star hotels, et cetera, et cetera. You can only do it so many times until Treasury locally calls back and says it's time for you to come back. Mm. We simply can't afford to keep you there. And so that's all part of the strategies to try and optimize your return. But I do think South Africa did come out of it a bit better.
Mm.
However, I do make the point at the expense of some of our regional neighbors.
Mm. Oscar, now, obviously, given your threat at the beginning of the book, I first want us to become friends before we have friendly fights on the show. You cannot discuss Mbeki's foreign policy without talking about Zim. Right, and this is about affirming your wonderful work as a scholar, and I mean this book that is so lucid, and I think will be great segue into all sorts of fascinating historical debates about his legacy. Just give us a taste, and the listeners can get the full version when they actually pick up the book, of how you approached the Zim issue, because you know how it is. Mbeki, people either love him or hate him. There's no in-between, and those of us who don't like him very much, our two favorite bits of evidence for dislike are obviously HIV/AIDS and then Zim, and those folks who care about political economy rush to point out that, no, don't give him too much kudos with ECOs either. We had jobless growth under his name. Mm. So let's talk about the Zim issue, because you are very clear that those of us who are, use that as a lightning rod with which to diss the guy, we're obsessed with normativity, and you think there are complications here that go beyond what are the normative or ideal ways of handling the situation.
Yeah. Yeah, no, firstly, it was a very complex crisis. Here you have a northern neighbor that for all intents and purposes were quite successful, the economy was quite stable, and so forth, and just unfortunately ran into a poverty trap and poverty debt. Because of the IMF and the World Bank. Okay. How do you mediate that situation? I think the South Africans under Mbeki was of the opinion that before you take out the stick, you need to try and incentivize and go with the carrot. Try to have the warring parties talk and resolve the matter.
Mm.
You would recall, Eusebius, that the history of Zimbabwe and the struggle of the people of Zimbabwe is such that it has always taken on a very violent and nasty turn, the killings and so forth. And so to avoid some of that, their approach by the Mbeki administration was, let's try and get people to sit down and talk and solve this thing. Touches on the argument, not that I want to open another can of worm, but it touches on this issue of justice and peace what actually should
take precedence.
Which
you opened the book with, because the al-Bashir matter also frames your main argument.
Absolutely. And so I think that the emphasis on peace is more important, because that's our experience as South Africans. When I interviewed Mbeki, just to give you some complexity, he makes the example, he says, We had a sticky point. We needed to talk to Tsvangirai and Mugabe in one room. They couldn't come to an agreement. It went on to the wee hours, and the media was waiting outside.
Hmm.
Eventually, we came to a broken arrangement, but it was nonetheless an arrangement. As we walk out, he says to me, as we approach the cameras, Mugabe grabs my hand. And now we are in front of the cameras, and I'm torn between, do I pull away and make, of course, a front page story, or do I just go with it?
Hmm.
And this is sort of some of the complexities. A simple example, but Mugabe really knew how to maneuver and play the game. And then, of course, it makes the front page. Best of buddies, comrades in arms. That's why they are together. And he was just making that example to illustrate that sometimes he himself was caught off guard and couldn't always calculate every possibility.
Mm.
That's the first thing. The second thing is that this regime change push by Tony Blair and Bush is very real. It's not some imaginary thing. You know, you would recall at the same time they had campaigns in Iraq, they had campaigns elsewhere in the Middle East in terms of regime change, and they thought it was a campaign that was working for them.
Sure.
Let's get rid of Mugabe. Let's put in a more acceptable administration. But that did require boots on the ground, heavy weaponry, and they wanted South Africa to be what Turkey is in most cases to the Middle East. And South Africa said no.
Mm. But the flip side of it is that so much time has now passed since Mbeki was president, that the foreign policy intent behind those very complicated choices at the time can now be measured with empirical facts, because history has marched on.
Sure.
If some of the intent included peace, prioritizing that over some normative idea of justice, entrenching, as you also suggest, self-determination in our post-colonial states. Many would argue that on the facts of what Zimbabwe looks like currently, there isn't really peace, if we stretch the concept. And certainly self-determination is not something enjoyed by the Zimbabweans living outside the borders of the country.
Absolutely. I do agree. However, you know, Judge Dennis Davies also wrote a piece post the book, The Mbeki I Know, in which he made the point about the Zimbabwe of 2016 is hardly, as you make the point. And my retort to that was simply, I agree with this. It's probably a true sentiment. However, the Afghanistan or the Iraq of 2016 is far worse off. Mm. And so, you know, and those again are some of the complications.
That's fair.
But I do want people to read the book and disagree with
they should,
including
it's
you.
It's very readable. It's very lucid. And I think absolutely Oscar is right. The connections between foreign policy, international relations, and what happens domestically is far tighter and real than many of us actually make out to be the case. Consistent or Confused, The Politics of Mbeki's Foreign Policy, 1995 to 2007, by Oscar van Heeren, Dr. van Heeren. It is available nationwide. You can get it from any reputable bookstore, exclusives as well. And I should also do a shout out. I know we're out of time here. Good forwards don't often get acknowledged. I really enjoyed, I don't know if you wrote it, I really enjoyed this foreward by former President Kgalema Motlanthe. I thought it was really on point, both how it was written and how it framed the entire book.
He did write it.
Absolutely. Oscar, thanks for coming in and all
Thank
the best
you very
for the
much.
Sales. Thanks. It's 11:30. Here's the latest in EWN headlines.